You're now listening to a Hip Hop Digest special interview with King Killer, Kurt G, and E Green.
Welcome to the Hip Hop Digest show. It's your man, DJ King Killer.
Don't forget about your boy, Kurt G.
Of course, it's E Green. Recording day. What up, Killer? Kurt?
What's going on?
What's good?
I can't make no noise.
Can I ask y'all to do something?
What's good? That?
I need you to listen closely. We got Master Ace in here with us, yo.
I'm in here. What's going on, y'all?
What's going on?
All right, thank you for being here. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Master Ace, for your listening pleasure on the Hip Hop Digest show. So, I don't know if we want to just jump right in to...
Yeah, this shit is almost surreal. I'm looking
yeah,
at it.
Yeah, it is. I know. It's we jump right in. But what we usually do on the Hip Hop Digest is when we have guests, no matter who they are, we have a set of standard questions that we ask folks. And we're going to put you to the test on that. And the first question would be, what record, tape, CD, cassette, no matter where you came in, hip-hop related that you bought with your own money?
Hip-hop, right?
Yes, sir. Well, it doesn't even have to be. Let's say, what was the first recording that you bought with your own money?
The first, I bought 245s, my own money. The first 245s I bought, one was Evelyn Champagne King, Shame. And the other one was Boogie Oogie Oogie, which was by Sal Soul. I can't remember the name of that group that made Boogie Oogie Oogie. Two disco records, though.
Oh, okay.
People don't realize, you know, disco doesn't get the credit that it should get for its role in developing hip hop, because we were really rocking off disco records first. And that was the first time I went to a store and bought a record, it was those two records on 45.
Okay. Now see, I often say that too. I was like, disco was so underappreciated. To be honest with you, I don't think hip hop wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for disco and all the things that disco provided hip hop at the time. So
but I will tell you what the first hip hop record I bought was, though.
Please.
It was Super Rhymes Rap by Jimmy Spicer.
Wow.
R.I.P.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
And I knew every word of that song. Like, I knew it all the way. And that was like probably a 7-8 minute song or something crazy.
Yeah, it was. Yep.
I knew every word.
No doubt. Indeed. And so the next question we usually ask is, who is your personal, and the key word is personal, top three MCs, means the most in your heart to you?
And I gotta say this also, we don't care if it was three niggas that grew up next to you, as long as you knew them and they was personal to you.
Okay.
Hell, it could be you.
In terms of, because that three would change depending on kind of the era. So my first top three, when I first really started, you know, rhyming and figuring out what I was trying to do, my top three at that time was Rakim, LL Cool J, and Big Daddy Kane. And I named those three because those were the three MCs that made me change what I was doing. Up to that point, everybody was rhyming how they were rhyming and nobody affected me. But when I heard Rakim, when I heard LL, when I heard Kane, I knew that I had to make adjustments to what I was doing. They sort of showed me what the bar was, and I knew I had to get my writing up to that level. So those are the first in my career or in my life. Those are the first top three. That was my first top three ever.
Oh, okay. So as you went on a little bit, your top three, it was it modified?
Yeah, it would change, you know, because then new cats would come out and come with some other styles, and I'd be like, oh, that's kind of dope. But like, a little bit later on, Chill Rob G was definitely one of my top lyrical dudes. I would say Chill Rob G for sure. You know, Lakim Shabazz. There's a few guys, man, that really to me set the bar with the lyrics after the Kane Rakim LL.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No doubt. Great voice. I tell you, Lakim Shabazz, Chill Rob G, just great tone in their voices. Excellent.
Yep. Definitely.
Definitely. So as far as, now I was saying that I didn't really have a whole lot of questions, but I guess my questions are usually just going to come from the recordings that I got, that I own from you. I don't know if you can see it here, obviously, Ace in Action, Letter to the Better. I guess my question about that particular record, at that time, was that recorded in studio or were you still at Molly's house or where was that recorded in the circumstances?
Well, Molly's house was in the studio.
Huh, indeed.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
that's where the studio was. I hadn't been to a proper studio for that during that period. I hadn't been to a proper studio. Everything I recorded was at his crib.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Nah, that's amazing.
My whole first album was done in his crib.
Oh, wow.
Crazy. Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing.
That's nuts.
That's absolutely amazing. I guess then I won't ask about this, but actually I think maybe this is just my personal favorite. Agatha.
Agatha, yeah.
Oh, my God. I love that record. I absolutely love that record.
Produced by DJ Mr. C.
Yes.
That was a really big record in London. That record took off in London. When me and the Biz was out, all the DJs in the UK, in London, they flipped it over and they were playing Agatha, and it turned into this huge record. Like, they actually had to re-release it as a export or import in London with that song just by itself. That's what Warner Brothers ended up having to do because it was such a big record out there.
Oh, wow.
And, when I finally went to London to perform for the first time, I couldn't believe the reaction to that record. Like, it was like, wow, like, word? Like, because nobody's talking about this record back in the States at all.
Wow, that's incredible. That's my favorite. I have to say, that's probably one of my favorite records. I love that record, so I guess I was on a different vibe at that point. So
that's all right. So was I.
So I don't mean to hog here. I just got a few records here. I'm looking at the Master Ace. It's a single. Don't understand what the B-side is. Acknowledge. I don't know if you remember that.
Of course, I got a bunch of those in the house.
Ah, indeed. So yes, yeah, certainly. At that point, let's see. What was the label on there? JCOR.
J-Core, yeah, that was our distributor. That was our distributor. We were indie at that point. That's when I became independent. M3, I've been on M3 since that time, and J-Core was our very first distributor.
Oh, and, okay.
When that record dropped, well, the album Disposable Arts, when it dropped, J-Core went out of business about 3 weeks after the album came out.
Wow.
So that was like a real downer for me because I really felt excited about the record. I was like, I really got a record here. People are responding to this record. This is going to be really something great. And they like, just one of the employees that was working on my record called and was like, hi, we came to work today and there's no more work.
Damn.
Wow.
Jeez. Wow. As far as being an artist, And are you a type of person, I mean, I'm not saying were you like a writer versus a freestyle, but I mean, what is your approach to, are you a type of person who would take beats home, you know, pick the beat you like and then write off of them, or you already have songs ready?
Well, early writing days, I could write a song with no beat in mind. I would just kind of like, in my head, I would just come up with words without a beat in mind. But I found over the years, I found that it's easier and it's more cohesive when I write to the beat because I can tailor the flow and the cadence of the rhyme to how the beat bounces. So I feel like my early, like first album with Marley, a lot of those songs were pre-written with no real beat in mind. But once I kind of got my groove in terms of creating music, making songs, I was better at tailoring the flow to the beat. And that kind of started, I want to say it started like my third album or so, around then.
Okay. So I got another record here. Got a young, fresh face, Master Ace. If you see that there. All right. So this record, I always was thinking about. It's as a fan, I was like, I wonder who's picking the singles. Did you pick the singles? Because obviously, Go Where I Send Thee to me was excellent. I mean, there was nothing wrong with Moving On, but Go Where I Send Thee, that's the one I was spinning off of that particular 12-inch. And I often wondered, I was like, wow, that Go Where I Send Thee, I thought was such a better record. I mean, than Moving On as far as the single presentation.
See, the thing is, I was distributed by Warner Brothers. That was the major. And so Warner Brothers, they were the ones who were really, you know, influencing what the singles were. Like, they wanted me in the biz. I didn't want me in the biz as the first single. Like, I tried to fight for it to not be the single. And Benny Medina, who was the president of Black Music at the time, he came right out and was like, if I don't get me in the biz as the first single, you might not get a second single.
Oh.
So man. I'm a brand new artist. Like, I'm not trying to ruffle feathers. I just know that I wanted music that had a little bit more, it was more representative of me. Me and the Biz was kind of like just a fun record we did towards the end. It didn't really represent what the album was, but he said, oh, we're going to capitalize on this whole Biz thing. And, you know, he was focused on the novelty of it, because that's Warner Bros. That's how they think. They think novelty, they think radio, they think, you know, R&B. Like, so Moving On had a little bit of R&B feel, but a lot of people don't know this, but that original Moving On beat was actually, Marley made that for Belle Biv DeVoe, and they didn't use it.
Ah, wow.
Oh. If you listen to it now, you'll kind of hear that a little bit, but that was a Belle Biv DeVoe beat that they didn't use. I was like, I'll rhyme on it, and boom, we use it.
All right. No doubt. Yeah. So as we go on, this is for monopolizing King Killer, my personal Master Ace record collection here.
All right.
The next record that I'm going to hear put up is right here, if you can see it, Slaughterhouse. And obviously, Born to Roll was on there. Delicious Vinyl at that point in time. You had got the Delicious Vinyl. I'm just assuming that these were your biggest records.
Well, in terms of sales and radio play, yeah, I would say yeah, definitely.
Okay.
But the fact that Born to Roll is on the other side of that is an interesting thing, because I had to fight Delicious Vinyl to put Born to Roll on that single, because you know the original version was Jeep Ass Nigga. And you know, they worked that record for several months. It did what it did. You know what I mean? It didn't work at radio. It didn't really pop the way they wanted it to. And they were ready to move on to the next single. Mm. I remixed Jeep Ass Nigga with this new beat. And I was like, ooh, this sound kind of dope. This could actually be something. Maybe this will work in other markets. So I presented it to them and they were like, why are we remixing Jeep Ass Nigga? Like, can we move on? And I was like, yo, this need to be on the single. And we had like a meeting where I was like, kind of like demanded that it be put on there. If you look at it, they didn't even put like versions of it. It's just one, it's just Born to Roll. That's it. Like,
yes.
They didn't put no instrumental, no nothing. It was just, all right, we're just going to make this guy happy and throw it on there. And they threw it on there. And what the hell happened? It ended up in the hands of DJs in the San Francisco and LA and Houston and Dallas. They flipped that joint over and everybody started playing Born to Roll. And now Delicious Vinyl's like, oh shit. Now they panicking, trying to read because of the video. Now we got to shoot a video. Now we shoot a video for it. And now they're panicking because people are going into the store and they're saying, I want Master Ace Born to Roll. And the record store was like, we don't have that. They didn't know that Born to Roll was on this other side of Slaughterhouse. There was no information out there for the stores to know. So unless you were like a record store head that knew, people will come in, ask for it. They were like, we don't have it. It didn't come in yet. We don't have it. So mad people for the first 2-3 months of that record being out and the video blowing up, nobody could buy it because they didn't know they didn't know that that it was on that record.
Wow.
So it took them around 4 months for Delicious Vinyl to press up do a new cover and press it as a standalone single and reissue it. By then, a lot of this theme had started to, you know, die down. It's like months later. So it was still getting tons of radio play and tons of video play, but they really lost the momentum. I don't want to say drop the ball, but, you know, fumble.
Yeah, indeed. Hey, you could say that, which obviously goes to the next one. I got it right here. Jeep-Ass Nigga on the B-side, Saturday Night Live, Clear Vinyl on that.
Clear Vinyl.
Yes, sir. Yeah, Clear Vinyl. So that was one of my records here. As we go on here, like I said, this is not in chronological order.
All right.
This seems to be a big record here. Master Ace, Sitting on Chrome.
Sitting on Chrome, yeah.
Wow, yeah, that, boy, I used to play the hell out of that record. Man, yes, sir. Sitting on Chrome. Now, what label is that? Is that still Delicious?
Still
yes.
Delicious.
Yes, sir. It is still Delicious. Indeed.
King Killer, you asking all these fucking personal ass record questions. I want to get into some other shit real quick.
Okay. Sure. No problem. I'm sorry. I didn't jump into my man fan there.
Now, yeah, I see that shit.
Over there. So let me ask this. I want to go back. I want to go way the fuck back, right? So when hip hop hit you, what was it? What was it about hip hop that caught you? And then I'm gonna give you a follow up question after that.
For me, it was the tapes. The tapes. It was a combination of the tapes from the parties up. We said uptown. We always say uptown. So uptown was Manhattan, Bronx, any place that was north of Brooklyn to us was uptown. And so they were having a lot of parties up there in different clubs and stuff, and they would record the parties. And then those tapes would get redubbed, and eventually they would reach somebody's hands in Brooklyn, and then those dubs of dubs would get passed around in Brooklyn, and we get dubs of dubs, and eventually it would get to us. And just hearing the MCs rhyming, you know, at the party, you could hear the crowd reaction, all of that was just like very cool and very exciting to me. So I started DJing. Like, we had a little crew, and we, you know, put together a little DJ setup, two mismatched turntables and a little mixer, and we started DJing in the crib, making tapes ourselves, and that was the beginnings of it for me.
Okay, so you said you started a DJ first. So mm-hmm. When did you start thinking about I could rhyme?
So as we were making these tapes, these you know, they were like breakbeat. Like, we were just cutting up breakbeats. We'll put on Good Times, and, you know, it's three or four of us DJing. So a whole half the 90-minute tape would be each dude getting their turn on Good Times. And then we switched the record. But as we started hearing more and more of these tapes coming down from the Bronx that had, like, real rhyming structure and routines and all of that type of stuff, you know, our instrumental tapes were sounding kind of boring compared to the tapes coming up from uptown. So I kind of decided, you know what, let me take this little routine. They did a little routine off Gilligan's Island. Let me take the Gilligan's Island theme and put my own words to it and do my own thing with it. So that's how it started, just to make the tape sound cool and better, so that when we played them in the neighborhood, people would be like, oh, that sounds like, you know, dudes uptown. So that's really how it started. Me trying to I would duplicate what they were doing, or what I heard on those tapes. And it was just so our tapes could sound more interesting and more better.
Okay. And I think that my brothers here would agree, you are one of the most consistent MCs to ever be doing it, right? So with that said, you know, you've been around for a minute, right? So you got all these changes that have happened in hip hop, like all these different styles, so to speak, to put us right to where we are today, right now. But with that, you've always maintained your style, your strict code of rhyming and all that. Have you ever thought about reaching out to the younger crowd, or has the younger crowd reached out to you?
the young audience has discovered me. Maybe not so much the young audience in the U.S. Although I did do an in-store, I did an in-store at a skateboard shop in like 2015 or 16 in L.A. And the line was out the door, and overwhelmingly, I would say 65% of the people there were kids under the age of 20. And that kind of blew me away. But in overseas, I have a very wide ranging audience in terms of age overseas. I have kids that come to my shows like 18 years old. This past May, January, February, we were in Europe, and there was kids coming up to me at the show like, I finally turned the age where I can get into these parties. This is my first show ever coming to ever. I've just turned 18, and it's my first time being able to come out to a club. And you're the first show that I'm seeing. So, you know, that's encouraging, but that's the results of me continuing to release music, new music. I didn't fall back on the music that I already had put out, and just, you know, I don't feel like, because I never really had that record that identified me to the masses in the U.S. You know, Special Ed, he got I Got It Made. That's his signature joint. Like, it's undeniable. You know, a lot of MCs, my contemporaries anyway, all of them have a record or two or three that is identifiable records to the East Coast U.S. markets. And they get booked and they do shows based on those records. And because they have those records, they'll never ever die out. They'll always have a place to perform, to rock. Those records will always get played at parties. As an artist, my catalog was a little bit different. You had to kind of be a little bit deeper into the music, and be a little bit more of a head to mess with what I was putting out, because it didn't crack on the radio. It didn't crack in the mainstream hip hop scenes the way some of these other artists did. So for that reason, I've never fallen back. I haven't had that record to fall back on. So I've continued to put out new music, which has kind of helped me to redefine myself every couple of seasons with new artists, with new fans, and new people discovering me for the first time. It's just two ways to do it, you know, or more than one way to do it.
No doubt. And here's a question you probably have answered a billion times, but I got to ask you for my own personal self. I consider the symphony the greatest posse record ever.
Me too.
You say you too?
Yeah.
I like that. With that being said, there's been a lot of other posse records. Is there any that you think could sit in the same role with the symphony?
Oh, definitely. Scenario, Tropical Quest. The Death Squad joint. I don't know
why. Headbanger.
What is it?
Was that Headbanger?
Yeah, Headbanger. To me, Protect Your Neck is a posse cut.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So there's a bunch. I mean, that's three off the top of my head right now.
Okay, but you agree, you would agree wholeheartedly that the symphony is probably the greatest posse record ever.
It's the greatest because it was the first of its kind.
Okay.
that's why it's the greatest, because it sort of solidified a new type of song. It established a new type of song that people weren't doing. Like, if Symphony doesn't happen, maybe Headbanger and maybe Protect Your Neck and some of those other records never even happened.
So would you say that Showdown would be a posse record, or is that a battle record more?
Showdown, which record is that? I'm sorry.
Sugar Hill Gang versus the Furious Five.
No, that's not a classy record. Not to me.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I got you. I got a question. So when, in terms of, I know you probably do a lot of interviews and everybody wants to sort of maybe concentrate on your, you know, obviously the beginning, the whole Queens thing. But as far as that go, producers, you work with a lot of producers. When I look at these records and I look at some of the names that produced, right? I mean, I'm seeing Louis Vega on the record. I mean, is there... any one particular person that that you enjoyed more than others, or was it more just a for hire thing as far as people, you know, producers that you work with?
Well, if you really look at my career and you look on the credits on most of my records, I was never really the artist that tried to find the who's who of producers and work with them. Mostly every album I put out has been with people that you didn't know before they worked with me. Louis Vega was known, but he was kind of known more on like house music and house mixes and stuff like that, party right. records. And I didn't even enlist him. I don't even know how. I thought the label did it, but it wasn't the label. I'm not sure how, but I wasn't aware of him. Somebody made, like, I think the label made him aware of me. Like, maybe he reached out to the label and said he had a beat. But generally speaking, I don't have that list of producers that people know that I work with. Most of the cats, I'm always looking for that young unsung talent that nobody knows about that got joints. That's how I've always, even on the early records, like I produced a lot of it, but the cats that you see listed as co-producers, or if I'm a co-producer, you don't even know who any of those people are, but they had talent. They had talent and they were willing to kind of let me drive the car. And that's what I really needed, because I'm trying to put together a particular type of record. I had a vision for what the record was going to be, what it was going to sound like. And if I was in a room with this big name and that big name and Pete Rock and, you know, Large Pro and Primo and this one and that one, it would be a little bit more difficult to drive the car, because everybody kind of has their way of doing things and everybody wants to go mix their own record and give me the record. I'll bring it to you when it's done. Like, and that's not how I am. Like, I want to cook the meal. So, that's probably why I chose producers that were a little bit less known, but had talent. And that's probably why I did it that way.
Okay. This is probably actually one of the few Juice Crew questions I have. Do you know of or have been a party to any type of Juice Crew documentary and or movie that it possibly could be coming out?
There was talk about a movie several years ago, 5-6 years ago. I don't know where that is now. It's not a completely dead issue, but I don't know if there's any movement on it right now. In terms of a documentary, Lil Daddy Shane was trying to work on a documentary. He actually interviewed me and others for that documentary. He has a ton of footage. He's backstage at all the Juice Crew reunion shows and interviewing people. But I don't know where he is with that. Like, he showed me an edit one day, but it wasn't like a real edit. It was like 4 hours almost of just back to back interviews, and I was like, "Yo, you gotta chop this down. This is not gonna work." Mm. He's like, "I know." So the last I saw of it, and that was probably 4 years ago when I saw that. So, I don't know. We'll see. You know, I have a feeling that everything has there's a season for everything. That time will come when the time is right.
Okay, indeed.
All right. A question just came to me. Because I'm sitting here thinking about Master Ace, and he's got one of my favorite albums of all times, and it's something newer. The joint you put together, The Falling Season, from start to finish, that shit, I can't stop it. I always got to play it all the way through, because the stories that you told on it, the way you told that from beginning to end, is crazy.
That's a great compliment that you have to play it from beginning to end, because that's what my goal always is to make a record that when it's like putting a movie into your your Blu-ray player, whatever the hell, and you're not gonna just watch the first two scenes and then turn it off. You're gonna wanna watch the whole thing. Even if you've seen it five times, you wanna watch the movie all the way through. And so that's what I've tried to do with my albums. So I appreciate you saying that. And that just, you know, lets me know that I'm doing the right stuff.
Yeah, with that album, I definitely, every time I got played all the way through.
Okay, well, since we're talking about I'm going to talk to, still on my phone, probably going to be on my phone for a while, is Brooklyn Story. And boy, I tell you, you and Marco Polo, that album is so spectacular. Oh,
the beats is crazy.
Oh my goodness.
The way you were just flipping the lyrics on that shit.
Yeah, Marco's a beast with the beats, and you know, he brought out another side of me. That's probably, that album right there is probably, I've probably done the most songs in my career, where there wasn't necessarily a topic, it was just going in, just spitting bars. That album was probably the closest thing in a while that I've had that many songs on it where I was just rhyming, just going in.
Okay, wow, that's incredible. I got another 12-inch. Okay.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
What it stand for?
EMC, what does it stand for? It's a great record. Yeah. That is absolutely a great record. See, what label was that on? That's M3, I think.
Still M3, yeah.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, produced by Nicolay.
Nicolay, yeah, man. Yeah, he's from...
Foreign Exchange, right?
Yeah, he's from the Netherlands, correct.
Yes. I don't know if I'm considered ahead or not, but I remember when I seen that and I seen who produced it, I was like, I got to buy this, you know.
You are definitely ahead. If you know who Nicolay is, you are definitely ahead.
So... Again, that was another great 12-inch. And I got one more. I got more, but this is the only ones I'm going to pull out for this interview. Here is another one that is absolutely a great record. Is the Master Ace right there, if you can see it. Yeah, Ghetto Like, produced by Socrates. Incredible. Incredible. Actually,
Socrates from Canada?
Yeah, Canada. Absolutely.
Yeah, oh, okay. And let me tell you something, G, and the B-side too, The Outcome, produced by Domingo, son.
Yeah.
Domingo?
Yes. So, yes, the man has worked with some talent. Indeed.
Absolutely.
With spectacular results.
Oh, I'll tell you what, this is a compliment, but you just seem to get better and better.
Thank you, man. That's... you know, as an artist, that's what you would hope for. You don't want to feel like you're, you know, losing ground. I tell my boys all the time, like out here, I'm not gonna say no names, but out here, like one of my contemporaries that put out a new song or some recent rhyme or something, and I'll be like, fellas, if I start sounding like this, can y'all just please just keep it real with me and tell me? Just let me know. So I, you know what I'm saying? Like I have no, I can bow out gracefully, but I don't want to, if I'm, you know, it's like a ball player. Like if you don't want to go out on the court and you looking sloppy and can't dunk no more and your shots is air balls. Like you don't want to get to that point. Like let me know so I know not to play myself.
You don't want to be the dude with the long socks and the high tops.
Exactly. I don't want to be like that. But please, when it starts sounding short, shaky, short. Just let me know, because, man.
Well, speaking of that, let me bring in some current event type situation. So we know the world is going crazy right now. There's a whole lot of stuff going on, a whole lot. But do you think that hip-hop has any responsibility in this Black Lives Matter, this whole protest situation? Do you think hip-hop has any responsibility in that?
Hip-hop has always had responsibilities. Hip-hop has always been the CNN of our culture, of our people. And I think as a community, and I'm speaking in the general sense of hip-hop as a culture, I think we've let our people down a little bit. because, and it's not all our fault as artists, but it's the fault of the music, the radio stations. It's the fault of us raising the next generation, the young people up under, you know, music that doesn't enlighten, music that doesn't inspire, music that doesn't have meaning. And there's nothing wrong with a fun record, a party record, a dance record, a little, you know, a little violent record here and there. The problem is that hip hop, which used to have Public Enemy and All Righteous Teachers and Boogie Down Productions and X-Clan, and, you know, Public Enemy and everybody, there's no balance to it. So everything is a party record. Everything is just not about anything important. It's about drug use and sex and, you know, materialism and alcohol consumption. And that's what our young generation is growing up on, unfortunately. Those records have always existed. There's always been, you know, those kind of records in hip hop. The problem is that we had other stuff, like some of the groups that I mentioned, that balanced everything out. You know, for every NWA record that was saying some crazy stuff, you had a Public Enemy record or X-Clan record to balance it out. And the problem now is that there's no balance. And so we've kind of, even though I'm not responsible for making those records, I have to speak about it as if we're an entire community and say that we've dropped the ball as a culture in terms of what we've done. We haven't done our part. And so what I hope happens now is as these events unfold, that some of these young artists, there'll be a shift in thinking. I can't say I'm super optimistic about that, but I hope that there's a shift in thinking, because with economy being shut down, nobody's making money. Nobody's booking shows because of COVID and this and that. You artists are sitting at home doing nothing, spending money, still trying to floss, still trying to, you know, walking around with your, you know, stacks of money to your ear, like the money phone and all of that. That stuff going to dry up real fast. And, you know, just that lifestyle is going to dry up real fast. And then it's going to come down to, okay, now you broke too. Now what? Mm-hmm. And so the answer to your question is yes, we do have a responsibility. We've just not been on the job as a culture. We haven't been on the job the way we need to be, and policing some of the music that's been coming out, and just putting the right balance of music out there. You know, we can demand that the radio stations balance this music out the same way we're demanding that the police stop killing people. We could demand that the radio stations play a little bit of everything. They don't want, they want us to think that they're in control, but they're really not. What's the control is their advertising dollars. That's what controls radio. So,
definitely.
You know, we can absolutely, you know, demand, you know, that that radio stations do a better job. I still remember when Kendrick Lamar, after he had won a couple of Grammys or Soul Train Awards and stuff, and he was coming out with his next project, and his first single was this joint called I Love Myself, which I thought was like super dope. The song was dope. You know, the sample was dope. It was just a dope record. And the message was dope. And I remember hearing it on the radio in New York like one time. Mm-hmm. He performed it on an award show, and the next day or the next week, that same week, it came on the radio in New York. And I was like, okay, this is good. This is gonna balance things out. This record is nice. The young people need to hear this. I love myself. This is a good message to hear. I never heard that record again after that. And I was like, what the hell happened? Like, what happened? I Love Myself couldn't get in heavy rotation? Why not?
So this is a question that King Killa and I, we addressed offline a couple days ago, maybe yesterday, but I made a comment. First of all, let me back that up by saying that I have like 100 nicknames on here, but one of them is Lil Malcolm, right? So that means I'm on my shit, and I'm usually on it deeply. But my new thing is, as I get older, I learned that I don't know everything. So I'm open to change. But my initial thought when I saw LL, and it's not just about LL, I'm going to explain. When LL came out with that verse he did about, you know, the current events, it was dope to me, but I'm kind of like, why now? And not just LL, but other people who are in public opinion, let's just say, are living comfortable in all throughout all this shit. You know, it's not like somebody just got killed one time or whatever. This has been going on since Obama was in office and before, right? So to me, it was like, okay, I'm kind of like, why now, yo? Do you just see this now? Why could you not speak out before? And my man King Killer was telling me that we have to receive all of it. We have to receive it no matter when it comes in.
Right.
Because it's something positive.
Right.
But I still haven't, like, reconciled that in my mind, because there are people like us who don't have the wealth to live in the hills or in the valley or wherever the fuck the best shit in D.C., what is it, Potomac, whatever the fuck it is now. So it bothers me just a little bit. And like I said, I'm open to more understanding about it. But what do you think about, you know, people jumping in the pool, or at least not jumping in, but at least getting in ankle deep in the water now and not before?
I will say this, like, and this really applies, you know, more to artists like LL, my contemporaries, guys that are my age or a little older or a little younger. Many of them have grown up. They've grown up as superstars, right? And they have their fans. They've sold their records, and this social media thing, this weird experiment that other people do, they're not really dialed into that world, and they're just now kind of discovering this. Like, I noticed LL lately, he's been doing he brings fans on to his IG lives and just lets them come on the air. There was a time when superstars like LL or Big Daddy Kane or somebody would never interact with the fans in that way. But it's a new age. And if you want to be, you know, if you want to maintain your relevance, you have to engage with your fans. And that's what social media has helped me a lot, because I used it. Once I discovered it, I immediately started using it. Like, so it's not new to me. But a lot of times the superstardom sort of comes with this inaccessibility thing that goes with it, where people don't really get to see you until you want them to see you, and they don't just have access to you like that. They can't just send you a message and say what up and you reply. I didn't come up that way so I came up like being more accessible. That's just how I've always been. After my shows, I come to the merch table, I meet every single person that wants to meet me, come up, take a picture, sign something, buy a shirt. That's what I always do. I'm accessible that way. So I feel like I'm more in tune with the fans that way. But I think that this is something new for L, the whole IG thing and the live, doing a live. He's just really just discovering this stuff. He's been in his own world, doing his own thing. He's acting, he's busy, he's running the Sirius station and all of that. And somebody, probably a publicist, because that's what it usually is. It's usually a publicist or somebody like that that says, yo, you really should start using your IG. And here's how you can use it. Put on your live and just let a few fans come on. And they show him how to use it. And it's like, and he probably did it the first couple times. Like, yo, this is kind of cool. People coming on, they're giving me props. They're showing me love. And I keep them on for a minute and a half. And I go and pull somebody else up. So he's really just, really, to me, I think he's really just kind of discovering it, and it's a new thing, and he's embracing it. And now, okay, so I can just spit a rhyme right now and just post it, and people are going to see it. Okay, I'm going to do it. And that's what he did.
Okay, but I get that. We've had the social media discussion for sure. No doubt. It is definitely not for artists who are in our age range, or as you say, we've discovered it now. It's definitely a new thing, like the new kid, the colorful kid. He uses it ridiculously, right? But that's deeper than that is even without social media, people are still able to speak out on things. There are different ways outside.
I know what you're saying.
And so that, right. And that point of it to me is like, and again, I don't want to make this about LL. It's because it's way bigger than that to me. But it's like when, even back in the day there in New York, when they had that, you know, that whole rally and the whole thing, and LL showed up wrong. You know what I'm saying? He showed up all golded out and all that kind of stuff. But it was, you know, it was African Medallion season, right?
Right.
It's like, do we still embrace celebrities? I'm going to say celebrities that have been mad quiet. Do we embrace them joining now? Or do we see it as opportunist or what have you? I don't know how quite to grasp it right now. Because I've been in the fight forever.
Yeah. The only way for me to respond to that is to say, whether he did it in the past or not, let's be happy he's using that platform now to say something, because he's going to reach a lot more people. Same thing with Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan hasn't said a word ever about anything social injustice of any type. He kept everything quiet. You know, his thing was Republicans buy sneakers too. And from what I heard, he made a statement this time for whatever reason. You don't know what, you know, you don't know what anybody goes through, or whatever, what anybody's way of thinking is. And it's almost like you're spinning your wheels to try to guess or figure out why they're doing it. You know, if it's an ulterior motive or whatever, I have no idea. You know, maybe Jordan's conscience just got to him. Maybe after that documentary came out, the 10-part documentary, because he was on record saying, when people see this, they're going to think I'm an asshole. So it very well could be when that came out, and he watched it. I'm sure he watched it from his home.
Right.
He sort of realized, wow, for the first time, people are going to really get to see the real me. And he don't like that. He don't like that. He's always kind of been just that mystery, you know, just the greatest basketball player. But you didn't really, unless you heard a personal story from a friend that met him, you never really knew really what his personality was, because he wasn't real vocal about anything except basketball. So now that doc came out and it's depicting him, and he comes off the way he comes off. You can take it or leave it. I think that had more to do with why he spoke out now, because of how he feels that he was portrayed, or how he felt people viewed him when they saw that documentary. So everybody has a reason, an agenda, a time in the season. Let's be glad he's using this platform. And that's as far as I can really go with it.
All right.
Oh, no doubt. And your words and King Killer's words, like I said, I come to the table with an open heart. So I'm trying to look for solutions. I'm trying to have us in a better situation, right? So from both you and King Killer saying that, it opens my eyes a little bit more, opens my heart a little bit more to say, okay, let go of the fact that they weren't talking about this 15 years ago when the shit was happening then, and just accept it now for what it is now and receive it. Because again, their audience is incredible, right? So they have an incredible audience socially around you. So if somebody who would have never heard LL or any of these other people speaking out, shit, the NFL dudes, I saw a video today of a bunch of NFL dudes, including the NFL, the Super Bowl MVP, who wasn't really talking that before. Now he's talking it. So I'm like, okay, I got to give Dak Prescott a pass. I got to start giving people passes to say, okay, you might have done this before, but your words right now are helpful to the cause of the better living experience for all of us. So I'm going to go ahead and accept that.
That NFL commercial was a straight up PR stunt, though. That was a PR. That's a PR
the
move.
The one with all the football players?
Yeah, that's a PR move. That's what that is. It's a PR move.
Now I'm fucked up again.
No, that's what it is.
I don't understand. Help me understand that.
Okay, because they as in the league, they have clearly blackballed Colin Kaepernick for coming back into the league. And now another major event happens, which is in line with exactly what he was protesting about in the first place. They have to do something because they're gonna end up with egg on their face. So this is what Colin was talking about. This is what he was kneeling for. You guys shut it down, kept him out of the league, and now something even bigger and crazier has happened, and now it's taken on a national, spotlight. And now you got white people protesting with black people in the street. It ain't just black people protesting. It's people of all shades and walks of life protesting. Everything the NFL does is a calculated decision to preserve their brand, to preserve their shield, to preserve their logo. And so what do? You get 10 or 15 popular players. Hey, man, you guys down to shoot this little promo for us? You down to do that for us? Sure, man. We'll do it. Because most of those guys, they just want to make sure those checks keep coming in, man. They want to play football, and they want those checks to keep coming in. A lot of those guys are taking care of a lot of different people. They don't want those checks to go away. They done seen the power of the NFL based on what they did to Colin. So, I hear you, but when we're talking about an individual versus a company, two different ways of thinking for me. And I view the NFL as a very calculated, because understand something. The NFL showed us 3 years ago that they only cared about their white beer drinking Trump supporting fans. That was priority one on their list. They were okay if black people stopped watching the sport. What they weren't okay with was if white people stopped watching the sport. And I don't know if you know this about me, but I've been an avid football fan since a child. Supported the NFL my entire life. You know, went to the games, huge fan. I'm sitting in my man cave with three TVs on the wall right now. I had three DirecTV boxes. I had three games going every single Sunday. After what happened with Colin, I canceled my DirecTV. First, I canceled my NFL package. Then I eventually canceled DirecTV. And I haven't watched three seasons in a row. I haven't watched the league. And I've been watching it since I was probably 10, 12 years old.
Yeah, I think that's the same for a lot of us. We're all huge football fans, but hasn't been the same since the Kaepernick situation. So there's no question about that. I want to, if I can, get back to music just for a second here. Sure. From your contemporaries, is there somebody out of the people that you named that you came up with, contemporaries that you didn't get to work with that you wanted to?
Well, one was last year, but that was DJ Premier, but that happened, so I was happy about that.
Okay.
We finally did a record together. I really wanted to work with Large Professor as going as far back as 2001 I really wanted him to be on my album Disposable Arts. I had a song that I wanted him to be on, but it didn't work out for whatever reason. I don't know. I don't think I have a list like that. I think, okay. I think because when I work on songs, what I do is I work on a song, I listen to the song, I listen to the beat, and then I say, who would be dope on this? Or who do I hear on this? And then I seek out that person to see if they down to be on the song. Some artists don't do it that way. Some artists say, I want such and such on my album. They don't have a song picked out. They don't have a concept for a song. They just, I want such and such on my album. And to me, those songs are cool, but it's not the same as handpicking the artist for the beat, for the song, for the concept. Ooh, like, yeah. I had, like on Long Hot Summer, I had Rapanoid on my album. I wasn't thinking about, collaborating with Rapanoid necessarily, but when I heard the beat and I listened to it, I was like, who would kill this record? boom, Nord. Mm. Nord would be dope on this record. And just like that, boom, I got a rapper Nord feature out of nowhere.
Nah, indeed, no doubt.
So on that joint you did with Paula Perry, that Kick It on the One.
Yeah.
That joint, did you had Paula Perry in mind on that joint? Or you just was Paula Perry from Brooklyn, that's one of my people.
Well, she was in my camp, so she was in the studio with me working on joints already. So, yeah, I mean, I wrote that song for us to do something together. You know, I wrote the whole song, and then I was like, yo, I want you to jump on here put your voice on here. Yeah.
That's what's up. Well,
if your entire library was in a fire and it was burning and nobody would ever be able to hear any of your songs again, and you could only save one, which record of yours would you save?
One song or one album?
One song.
That's tough.
we can say album if it'll make it easier for you. What album?
Okay, if it's one song, I would say Beautiful. If it's one album, I would say Disposable Arts.
Oh wow! Okay,
that's ironic. It's the music is about to be destroyed, but you're gonna grab the Disposable Arts. That's pretty dope.
Yep.
Indeed. So I don't have any more questions. Any of you guys got any more questions? I have to say, oh my goodness, it's such an honor to have you on the Hip Hop Digest. It's incredible. It's like I said, I pulled out all these 12 inches, and that wasn't even the albums because I left them on the shelf. So,
all right, you got a nice little library there.
So
that's only half of it. You ain't can't see the other only side of the room.
And some in the other room. It's crazy.
Right. Well, you know, we have to ask all of the legends, we have to ask this question. It's a very important question. So, what do you see as your legacy in hip hop?
I've been asked this before, and my answer is always the same. I don't feel it's my place to state that. I feel it's the place of the fans, journalists like yourselves, the people that buy the music, consume the music, to determine where I fall and where I fit. And, you know, if you guys can come to a consensus and agree on what my place and what my contribution has been, I have to be, I have to accept that and be happy with that.
Wow, that's 100. Yo, we never had that answer before.
Again, Master Ace, we thank you for being on the Hip Hop Digest.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Indeed.
So you should keep making that banging ass music.
Definitely will, brothers.
Okay, you take care of yourself.
All right, y'all.
All right.
One.